Welcome, Blazers fans, to the Blazers Edge podcast. I'm Dave Deckard, one of your hosts, the managing editor of BlazersEdge.com, and you can find this podcast just about every week on iTunes, Stitcher. We're like the Philadelphia Phillies. We don't care what kind of catcher we use. You can find us everywhere. And for those of you who are used to listening to us, we have a brand new co-host. Phil Nasons has gone on to tennis heaven, and he's somewhere in the hinterlands of Maine somewhere now. So we thank Phil, and we bid him adieu. It was a wonderful year with him. I am joined by a brand new co-host, but not new to Blazers Edge. He's written some of your favorite columns this year. He is Dan Marang. How is it going, Dan?
Good, Dave. Great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And Dan, if you haven't read his work, you need to go back and read it. He's thoughtful, he's provocative, and he does radio work in the local area as well. So we should have a wonderful time together. And let's dive right into it. As we speak, we are right in the middle of the Golden State-Portland series. Game one is in the books. The Blazers kind of got crushed. Dan, any surprises for you for game one? How did that go relative to what you expected?
It's about what I expected as far as the end scoreline. The big surprises for me came within the granularity of the game. I expected Lillard to perform a little bit better. Now we're hearing a bit that he may have had a pretty serious chest cold. Thompson had bothered him quite a bit during the regular season, but I figured with Thompson having to carry the offensive burden, he wouldn't be able to apply as much pressure to Lillard as he did during the regular season. So that surprised me a little bit. Bogut being clearly as effective as he was, and the ineffectiveness, kind of the back and forth, the ping pong action, you will, of Mason Plumlee, kind of reflecting more back to how he looked during the regular season when he was outmatched physically by a guy like a Bogut. But beyond that, it kind of went as far as I expected to the script. Game one in Oakland, that team, historic level, the young upstart Blazers. They backed into the series against the Clippers and obviously struggled against the CP3, Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan lineup and excelled. Well, probably didn't even excel when Griffin and Paul went down, even with a gimped up Redick. So some of the surprises weren't all too surprising, but it was a little different.
Yeah, you know, the recap article that I did, the Bogut thing is interesting because I highlighted rebounding, which was not exactly shocking, but it was a big deal that the Warriors clearly rebounded better than the Blazers did. And as I thought about it, there are games when the Blazers move around the opposing big guys, and there are games when the Blazers get moved around by the opposing big guys. And that was one of the big developments, I thought, in the Clippers series, is that they learned how to move around DeAndre Jordan a bit instead of getting shoved aside. It was back to square one in game one. I mean, that Bogut was so dominant that their entire front court had a dozen rebounds apiece. That was a little bit of an issue.
Yeah, Bogut looked more like the Milwaukee Buck version of Bogut. He didn't look like the I play 10-minute stretches here or there for the Warriors version of the Bogut. He was physical. He was dominant. And on both ends of the floor, rebounding, blocking shots, stretching out, recovering, and then allowing Draymond Green to kind of do Draymond Green things. And if that version of Bogut's going to be there, whether with or without Steph Curry or a healthy Damian Lillard, that's a really difficult obstacle for the Blazers to overcome.
Yeah, absolutely, because what it does is it makes the Blazers stop paying so much attention to everybody else, which I think you just identified, and that's a perfect description of what happened with Green. Sure, the Blazers switched a lot of guys defensively, and none of it worked, but the one thing the Blazers couldn't do is they couldn't really send a lot of extra men and make it stick, because Bogut was being so dominant, and they got to clock him, they got to shove him, they got to run him around, they got to do something in order to make him less effective. And look, another hidden stat in there is that Golden State did everything they wanted on the break. The Blazers kind of did what they usually do too, but that's not unacceptable. That's not going to win this series, because those Golden State front court players, the older ones, even though the team likes to run, they're not going to run run up and down the floor the whole game. And you got Mason Plumlee should be able to be leaving Bogut in his dust. And that is that's just not happening. Golden State won that battle not only by the margin that, you know, that's acceptable. They won it by a margin that's going to make a difference.
Yeah, no, the one thing I noticed right away in the first couple possessions was that the Warriors weren't sending anybody the offensive glass. They wanted to take away any early opportunities for the Blazers right out of the gate. They got back on defense every single time. That was a concerted effort no matter who was out there in the lineup. So that was the first thing I noticed. The second thing I noticed was defensively how they switch and recover. They wanted Andrew Bogut under the rim, and they wanted Draymond Green in the high post to be able to switch and apply pressure wherever necessary and then allow Bogut to protect the rim. They didn't care who their other players matched up on as long as Bogut stayed inside and Green stayed somewhere to help within, you know, arm's reach. And he's a fantastic defender, but getting him to rotate or getting anybody else to rotate off of somebody is really difficult because even if you do manage to do that, you're running into another guy who's 6'7", who's 6'8". The interchangeability across that lineup, with the exception of Bogut, you're literally Barnes, Green, Thompson, Iggy. I mean, every single Livingston, every one of these guys is 6'7" or 6'8" or 6'9". It doesn't matter which way you slice it. They're all present the same basic challenges that a 6 foot tall Chris Paul or a 6'3" Steph Curry don't present to a guy like a Lillard or a McCollum.
Right, so. And the spacing on the floor there was critical too, because what do you do? If you have Bogut down low, he's obviously there to protect the rim, but also to rebound, keep the Blazers off the offensive glass. But if you've got Green or somebody in that upper key area, what happens to Mason Plumlee's passing then? You know, he can't, and it's not like you've got a big guy out there, because you don't need a big guy out there, because Plumlee's not going to turn and shoot that shot. All you need is a guy who's agile enough to get up in his business so he cannot spin and survey the floor, and he can't get a clean pass away, and all of a sudden Plumlee is neutralized as far as that kind of mid high post part of the offense.
Yeah, if you take a look at what the Clippers did, they trapped and blitzed with DeAndre Jordan, so their primary rim protectors is at times 30 feet away. So that's where that initial play from Plumlee came from, as a guy like Mbamute, who's on the weak side in the low post, comes up and takes away that airspace for Plumlee, but at the same time you're sacrificing a wide open jump shot for Henderson or Harkless or Aminu. And the Warriors did that to an extent, but they didn't allow Plumlee to be the one to make that shot. It had to be off a penetration play from Lillard, a penetration play from McCollum or Henderson. The kick out three was there, but only because they collapsed the defense in the traditional sense, not because they were pressuring or trapping the guards up top. It was a typical drive and kick, but the Warriors are so good and defensively, and they play on such a well-oiled chain, I guess, that they recover to that. That drive and kick to that one spot, that isn't going to do it. You have to drive and kick to that one spot, swing it again, swing it again, swing it again. You have to give up the good shot for the better shot, and that's something the Warriors have nailed down offensively and defensively better than anybody else in the league.
Right, and I would say that Lillard actually did a pretty good job getting into the lane, but the Warriors know that that's not his favorite game. He'll do it, and he'll do it well, but he doesn't like to be getting in there on multiple drives. He would prefer to take the shot, or he would prefer to drive and dish. Now, the guy that they did brilliantly against, I think they were willing to let Aminu have the shots that he got. They were willing to let Harkless. And in that sense, you're right, they echoed the Clippers' defense, and smartly so. But the guy they did a really good job on, I thought, was McCollum. And it was almost like they said to Lillard, we're willing to let you do some damage as long as you have to dribble and get bumped doing it. But we're going to deny McCollum the ball. We're going to be all over him when he gets it. And he's going to have to make some spectacular one-on-one moves in order to get even a shot off. We are just not going to let him free, because we know that you might score on that drive. You might get some free throws. But if CJ isn't putting up 25, you're not going to win.
Yeah, what was really surprising to me is that, like I said earlier, is that without Steph, I didn't think Klay would be the one that would pick up Lillard, because Klay has to pick up so much of the offensive burden with Curry down. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit surprising to me when Livingston is the one that picks up McCollum. Now, granted, Sean Livingston's 6'7", 6'8", long, athletic, pretty solid defender. Klay Thompson does not get the credit he deserves for being the defender that he is. During the regular season, he drove CJ crazy. He absolutely just bothered him. Now, later in the season, they swapped Klay onto Lillard and really bothered Lillard. So, I mean, I think that shows the unique defensive ability that Klay seems to have. Now, McCollum figured it out later in the game that staying out of the pick and roll was his best way to score. And I think that kind of echoes your sentiments about taking away McCollum, is that any time that he tried to work, particularly out of the pick and roll, he was trapped, or not a full-on blitz or a press out to the outside, but they made it very clear that you were not going to get into the paint or get to that mid-range pull-up. Now, second half, McCollum figured out very quickly that he could sit whoever he had on him down in isolation. He and I know this is sacrilege to even say this, but McCollum reminds me of Roy in a sense, because he has this innate ability to change speeds and change directions while lulling a defender to sleep without being the most explosive athlete on the planet. His hesitation dribble, there was two or three straight possessions where he went at Livingston in the third quarter, I believe, and you could see Livingston's ankles wiggle. Like he was doing everything he could to keep from putting on a highlight reel. And that was what was like the light clicked on finally.
No, exactly. And this gets to your point too about the Warriors' interchangeability, is that when you go into the screen with them, you are essentially inviting a couple of 6'7" players to not only shade onto McCollum and kind of trap him, but even if you get the switch, which is theoretically a mismatch, he's still got a guy on him who's substantially taller and not near as quick as he is, but quick enough to stay in his vicinity. And this is the thing with CJ. People say, well, he's average height for a shooting guard. I think technically that's true. Is he average height for an amazing shooting guard? Because look at this team right now. Blazers don't just need an average shooting guard, and CJ isn't going to be paid like an average shooting guard. He's going to be paid like an astonishing shooting guard, which he can be. But, asterisk, when you get guys on him who are athletic and who are legit 6'7", he has to work pretty hard to get free, and it's not his most comfortable position. He plays really well against average guys, or guys who are, you know, average shooting guard height, but he's not, there's a little bit of kryptonite there in the height issue. Not that he won't score, but it's going to be harder for him.
Yeah, it may not be nearly as efficient, and my harshest criticism of CJ heading into this season, the first quarter to half season, when I started doing some evaluations on him, were two things. One, he's historically bad at generating free throws. I think we've covered that to, you know, we've beaten that horse to death. Also that he struggled finishing inside. Now, he turned the corner a little bit when it comes to finishing inside, particularly in traffic. I think just some regular seasoning, so to speak, is kind of what kicked it over to that end to make it to where it's an acceptable deal. The generating free throws is something that in the playoffs in particular, because the whistles disappear, those become ever more valuable. Now, if he can find a way to get to the line, to get guys like Klay Thompson, who is foul prone, if he can get those guys in foul trouble, then you may see one of those guys get freed up. You may see the defense relax. And I think that may end up being a key heading into game two, is when you make that adjustment, is that you've got to put more pressure on them. You've got to put it on in the half court. You've got to put it on in transition. You could see Coach Stotts continually get to the point where go, 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 but they're still playing at, you know, a three-quarter pace. They're not really buzzing around. And the only time you ever saw them really crank it up to 11 in the Clippers series, they were prone to mistakes. And I think some of that has to go back to not playing at that pace so much during the regular season. So they're not quite used to it, but I think those are the kind of the keys you have to look for, because I don't think you can count on Plumlee having a miraculous, you know, revelation like he did against the Clippers.
You can't even count on Aminu hitting the shots that he hit in game one.
No,
I mean, the caveat here is that the Blazers lost by a dozen in a game where Aminu really did pretty well, and Plumlee had a really nice game, except for shooting. I mean, he was, what, 0 for 7,
yeah.
So there's that. But, I mean, a lot of things went kind of right for the Blazers in game one and still didn't turn out very pretty.
No, the cursory guys, the guys on the outside definitely did their thing. Lillard's bottom scoreline, if you just look at the raw stats, ended up being pretty decent. But I mean, a lot of those points were made up when the game was already decided. But it was nice to still see him get free and show that he could do some things in areas that he hadn't really excelled in. You know, I've been critical of Lillard, particularly in his matchups with other higher level all-star point guards and his struggles that Ben Golliver at Sports Illustrated documented since he hit the shot against Houston. So I think those small gains, seeing we've only had one game out of seven,
right,
where both Lillard and McCollum have been effective and efficient, and
yep,
it was a laugher.
Well, you know, there's something to be said for when you get blown out, basically you're playing that fourth quarter not as the fourth quarter of the game you lost, but as a warm-up for the next game, which you hope to win. And Lillard, I think, performed well enough to give the Blazers some hope there, and perhaps to give himself some inspiration that maybe he won't hold it for the fourth quarter next time. But, you know, the other thing that's funny about this, I've read all over the place, well, the Blazers did win the final three quarters of that game, and it's like, well, I was at the perfect first quarter where the Blazers blew out the San Antonio Spurs, like, what was it, 49-19 or something ungodly like that.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the score. You know what? San Antonio won the last three quarters of that game too, I think, or at least they made up, you know, they made up huge difference. The Blazers did not end up winning by 30.
The only thing the Blazers had going in that quarter was that they weren't the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Yes.
That's the only thing they had going with the way the Spurs beat the Thunder in the first quarter of their game. That was the only saving grace of that first quarter.
That's right. Well, because the Thunder are too, they've been there before, so they're like, screw it, we lost this game. Blazers are young and hopeful yet. So, you know, hopefully that'll carry over to game two. What do you think they need to do in game two to maybe have a more positive outcome?
To me, the big keys are the guards, Lillard and McCollum. Getting into the offense earlier, getting in the transition is a huge one, which is kind of ironic because neither McCollum or Lillard are great transition guards. They're great on the secondary break on the pull-up three, but as far as getting out in the open and getting transition points, they rank towards the bottom of the barrel for starting guards in the NBA. A guy like Steph Curry, he's right up there at the top at almost 7 points a game in transition on his own. I mean, you look at Lillard and McCollum's stats, and they barely equal that together in a regular season game. So the team as a whole needs to get out and run. Getting Lillard and McCollum going early with some easy shots, it sounds so cliche, but it's huge. If you've watched Lillard in these games that he struggled so mightily in, his first two or three shots are step-back, fade-away, off-balance twos. I mean, we're talking about the worst of the worst shots. Now, when he has it going, I have zero issue with him taking that. It was because when he has it going, everything he puts up seemingly feels like it's going to go in. But he's got to work for the good shot. He's got to square up, get his feet underneath him. In the closeout game against the Clippers, early on, he got a couple really good, clear looks at the hoop, knocked him down, and he had a nice, consistent flow to the game from there on out. So I think that's got to be where they establish it early going into game two. And I'm sure the Warriors will be looking for that.
Yeah.
Secondly, they have to rebound. They have to gang rebound. And here's where Stotts has got to weigh his risk analysis. Do you send guys to the board on the offensive end and risk letting these guys run back on transition? To me, I say no. I say get back. If you want to leave one behind, if you want to leave Plumlee behind, if you want to leave Davis behind, fine. Everybody else has got to get back. And along that line, when you're taking shots, they've got to be shots where the floor is balanced well. I think that's something that's overlooked quite often, because if you're going to get into that shot 20 seconds left on the shot clock and guys are still jogging up the court, and all of a sudden you've got a long rebound to the other side of the floor and they're running out, that's going to be 2 or 3 points going the other way. This is a team that thrives on that kind of action. So that's the crux of it, is getting those two guys going earlier and rebounding the ball. I mean, if those things happen, then, you know, you've got a puncher's chance.
Yeah, you know, I guess I would augment that a little bit. Separation is part of what you're talking about for the guards. And you could tell by Lillard's form, especially. As you say, you watch his first 2 or 3 shots, they'll tell you everything you need to know. If he's sideways, if his feet are spread everywhere, it just shows up that he's not comfortable, and those shots are probably not going in. If he's lined up, if he's releasing quickly and straight toward the bucket, and, you know, basically what that means is if he's got a couple feet of space, then he's good to go. And I'm not sure that he can get that entirely on his own. I mean, the Blazers may have to scheme a little bit to get him free of whoever's on him. But basically, they need to find him that 2 or 3 feet of space pretty consistently and make those play number 1, 2, and 3 in the first period. The other thing is, you mentioned rebound. I would augment that with just the physicality. I mean, they cannot get pushed around. And yes, Golden State is bigger at some of the positions, but you know what? The Blazers played pretty physically against the Clippers when they got their mind to it. And they have to come in there and not be intimidated. Whether or not they get the actual rebound on a play, I'm not going to stress about. As long as they're somewhere near the position, or better put, as long as Golden State isn't just waiting there, eating up those rebounds like they did so many times on both ends of the floor on Sunday, they got to put a body into someone, and that's all on the front line. I think that's all on individual effort. Plumlee, Aminu, Harkless have just got to throw themselves into this game. Otherwise, no matter what the guards do, I don't think that they can get enough separation on the scoreboard to make a difference.
Yeah, I don't know what your take is on this, but I've kind of batted this around with a few other people, is that this is still a really young team, and this isn't to excuse it, but outside of Lillard and to an extent McCollum, these guys don't have that experience. I mean, you could tell right away in game one that Harkless and Aminu wanted nothing to do with shooting that ball in the first 5 minutes or so. And I'm sure that translates over to the other side when the defensive end, if you're trying to get physical, trying to get yourself into the game, you're just trying not to make mistakes as opposed to just playing. And it looked a lot like they did in games 1 and 2 in LA. So I don't know if it's just going to be a growing process that they kind of have to go through it. And I guess this kind of goes back to the, you know, whether you, that whole idea of having a playoff experience kind of comes through. But it's one of those things where when I look at it, right away, I literally just said out loud, they both look terrified.
Yeah, and I think that you see some of the weaknesses in the not necessarily the experience argument, but the idea that the Blazers are getting a ton of experience right here. They're getting beat right here. And I think they're getting beat pretty handily by teams that are intact, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that you can argue. The Blazers did a lot of things in the first round well, okay? And they won those games. But legitimate credit to them, as we said over and over. But look, if you got a flashlight to get you through the night, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning and the sun comes up and you turn on your flashlight and you say, I made it light. Okay, the sun might have had something to do with that too.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the injuries were the sun in that Clippers series. And you can point to 100 other things. You lit candles, you lit flashlights, you rubbed 2 sticks together. The sun did it. And the Blazers have not yet had that experience this year of looking at a fully armed and operational team that was supposed to beat them and actually beating that team. They can make all the noise they want, and everybody can say up against us against the world, and their media can, you guys are fools for thinking they couldn't win it. Well, you know what? They couldn't win it when the other team was healthy.
Yeah, just, the only time it happened was the Warriors game post All-Star break. I mean, mm-hmm. They had that game, and they had the one against the Thunder.
Well, game three against the Clippers, too.
The first half, when Paul and Griffin still looked like Paul and Griffin to an extent, and Redick wasn't dragging his leg behind him. And I've on record as saying is I still think that even with the or with had Paul and Griffin, everybody else stayed healthy, at least in game three, that the Blazers had a 65-70% chance of winning that game. They controlled the tempo of that game. So there was a little glimmer of hope to grasp onto there for Blazers fans that, hey, you know what, maybe they do belong. And I think it's fair to say that the Blazers belong in the playoffs to an extent, but I don't think you're going to find too many people arguing that they belong here in Golden State with, you know, a fighting chance against the reigning NBA champion and, you know, reigning MVP coming back. And then you've got a guy like Thompson who isn't just the best two guard in the NBA. He's putting on not a Steph Curry-like performance, but I mean, the opening 5 minutes of game one looked an awful lot like a 6'7" Steph Curry.
Yeah. So look, Clippers was 4-2 probably for the Clippers had they stayed healthy. I think this has 4-1 or 4-2. I think the Blazers are going to win a game. I think they have enough talent and a good enough playing style versus Golden State to do that. But yeah, I don't even if they won this series, something's up. So in any case, as we close, let's move on to that subject a little bit about personnel. First of all, a question that came up on Golden State of Mind, our sister site. It was interesting. Klay Thompson or Damian Lillard, which do you prefer?
Ooh. See, this one could get me in trouble.
Yeah,
because
I've
prefaced any time I've ever talked about Damian because I know the inevitable torches and pitchforks that comes out if I say anything negative about him is that I love him. I think that for this franchise, he's the right player at the right time. He has the right attitude, the aura, the persona, the way he carries himself, his leadership, all the intangibles you could possibly want. It's the tangible stuff that drives me nuts. I love the fact that he's got the moxie to take the shot when the clock's winding down. I love that he hit the shot against the Rockets. But if you take a critical look, an objective critical look at everything he's done since that time, the things that stick out to you immediately are terrible shot selection. Everybody talks about how he hits these amazing, you know, Steph Curry-esque 30-footers. Nobody mentions the fact that he's 42% from the field. Steph Curry shot 45% from three and took over 900 threes. So it's clearly a huge disconnect in the legend of Lillard in Portland and the real Damian Lillard and how he's executing. Don't get me wrong, nearly 25-7 on the regular season, you're talking about a list that's really short historically in the NBA. But right. It's the consistency. Ben Gulliver used to go back, he used to rate things on the shake rating, and Lillard has these spikes that's just,
He got a lot of flack for that, actually, but yeah, go ahead.
I know, but it's something I go back to every now and then when I have a little idea to just kind of check some things. And he has these spikes that kind of go up and down. Thompson, even if he's not on offensively, which does pop up from time to time, is one of the better defenders in the NBA. He is foul prone. But if you're asking me which player I have to choose one or the other, I'm going to take Damian, but it's not head and shoulders above. It's because of the intangibles. Those if Klay Thompson had that
like
leadership
you're
mentality.
Out here, Dan. I feel like you're wimping out. If you're going to take Klay, go ahead, take him.
I really want to take him. I'm not lying. It's just I haven't seen him put a franchise on his back. So, I've seen Steph Curry do it. I've seen Damian Lillard do it.
Defense is all Klay.
No,
I think pure shooting is all Klay. We've got to say, though, that Klay has a better lineup around him, for one thing.
Oh, yeah.
Lillard still, Lillard had that experienced lineup with Aldridge, but that they didn't have a ton of seasons to mesh, and that was Aldridge-centric offense, not necessarily. It was Dame fitting into LaMarcus's scheme, not vice versa. Mm-hmm. The other thing is just off the dribble, the ability to handle the ball and make plays. I think that's all Dame.
That's
Klay
10 to
good,
1. One's not even close.
So for that reason, for the Blazers, I will go with Lillard because I think they need that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I don't think McCollum has that quite in the same way. I think he could develop it, but I think Lillard just has more natural ability there. But if you were to take one player, say, to stick on Team USA right now, and you could only consider, like, this summer, that's it, you might have to go with Klay Thompson. I mean, because I think you can get people to do what Lillard does, kind of, but Klay is really extraordinary, almost a non-such in terms of what he does.
Yeah, there's maybe a couple other guys in the league, save Jimmy Butler, Wes pre-injury. I mean, but if you're talking about guys that have two-way ability to really put the ball on the floor, knock down a shot, play defense, yeah, I mean, the number of guys in that 6'6 to 6'7 range, you've got Butler, Wiggins. I mean, it's not a real, I mean, you can't even throw Harden's name in there without just giggling uncontrollably. Maybe a DeMar DeRozan, but even then you're limiting yourself offensively with his jump shooting ability. So if you're talking about getting a guy to fit into a scheme, I take Klay every time. If you're talking about getting a guy to build a scheme around, it's going to be Lillard because of his intangibles.
Klay is kind of the Maurice Lucas to Steph Curry's Bill Walton, just in the guards instead of, you know, he wouldn't carry a team on his own necessarily, but he's perfect fitting next to the guys next to you. Okay, let's get Lillard some help really quickly. We've talked to Dwight Howard, the other weekend version of the podcast did Dwight Howard a whole lot. Any interest at all in Dwight Howard? Yes, no?
No. God, no. Just no. I mean, on paper, fantastic. He provides you rim protection. He's a rebounder. He finishes around the rim. He's got a decent set of post moves. Off paper, in reality, he's a nightmare. He's a headache. He ruined a franchise in Orlando. That one's an objective one. It doesn't even matter. There's no Kobe. There's no James Harden. Just everything that you ever need to know about what he does to franchises happened in Orlando before he ever went to L.A. Then he went to L.A., ruined that franchise, went to Houston in concert with James Harden, ruined that franchise. I want no part of him. I would take Chris Birdman Anderson at his craziest here in Portland before I would take Dwight Howard.
I think that's a version of Dan Morang no right there, folks. Get used to that. Yeah, I mean, I would have more hope with him with the Blazers if he had a little bit of self-awareness, which he probably doesn't, but this may have humbled him a little bit. In any case, he's going to be too expensive for what he gives. How much would you give for Paul George if the Blazers could get him? If the Indiana called up right now and said, look, you know, we're interested in trading Paul George. We like player X or players X. How much would you give to get him on this team?
McCollum, Aminu, a first, and somebody else. And I can say that without even blinking. Paul George is. Look at his playoff numbers, not just this year, but before the leg break. Look at it. I mean, the guy is a prime time playoff performer. When the lights shine the brightest, he gets it done, and he's another one of those guys that is absolutely a two way player.
Mm-hmm. Perfect age too. Yeah. I think undoubtedly, would you trade Lillard for him? Would that be
you would have to, that would probably be the starting point that the Pacers would go for. That one's a tough one for me just because of that broken leg. That leg scares me. And that's the only reason why I start with Aminu or McCollum Aminu, a first and somebody else. That's why I center the package around CJ first. But it's not crazy to suggest Lillard for George. I don't think by any means.
How about someone cheaper? Rudy Gay is going to be floating around. And, you know, Blazers need some offense at small forward. I mean, if you gave Gay some of the shots that Aminu have been getting, obviously you don't have the defense, but you wouldn't have that scoring hole there. Any interest in him?
For the right price, you could talk me into it. Rudy Gay has been a guilty pleasure of mine since he came in the league. I don't know why. There's just something about having somebody who can handle the ball at that position, who can play make a little bit, who can do a little bit of everything. He kind of reminds me of a poor man's Joe Johnson. He can play defense. He can knock down a shot. He can put the ball on the floor.
He can play defense?
He can play defense when he's engaged. I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen. I said can, not will.
Okay, I guess I gotta tell you guys, if you thought the controversial opinions were gone, now that Phil's gone,
he can play defense.
Okay, all right. I'll buy it. I haven't seen as much of it.
No,
confident, but yeah. Okay, go ahead.
I think getting out of a place that's as crazy as Sacramento could be beneficial to him. Uh-huh. But for the right price, you know. Right now, I think the Blazers have too many guys that are fantastic bench guys, mm-hmm. and not enough guys that are starters.
Mm-hmm.
If Al-Farouq Aminu was coming off the bench, I think you're in really good position. If Mason Plumlee was coming off the bench, you're in really good position. Those are guys that Aminu's not a bad starter by any means. I think that he just lacks in areas of consistency that can be hindrance upon expectations on a nightly basis, especially in the playoffs. I think with a guy like Gay, you're going to get a certain level every single night. Aminu, you're going to get a certain level every single night defensively. Offensively, it's 6 of 10 for 3 or 0 of 6 from 3. You just don't know. And I think with Gay, you would get some of that consistency. Now, would it be consistently good? Meh, I don't know. But, I mean, for the right price and with the way the free agent market plays out, it's hard to say no, but it's also hard to say yes just because there'd be a serious logjam at that position. But at this point in time, you would be saying goodbye to either Crabb or Henderson for certain. And it still remains to be seen what's going to happen with Meyer. So there's a lot of money that's out there, but there's a lot of decisions that need to be made. So,
no, exactly. And, you know, Gay would be semi-expensive. I mean, there's some conflict as far as what his contract is, but, you know, it's supposedly pushing $20 million a year, which is pretty steep for him. On the other hand, the Blazers have that money, and they haven't spent it on anything yet. See, I was really hoping that Al Horford would have a rotten playoffs, so that, you know, there would be some doubt there as far as his desirability. But
he hasn't been spectacular in some parts. There was early games against the Celtics where he wasn't quite on par. Millsap carried them for a couple games, so. It still remains to be seen whether or not Horford's asking price is going to be there. But, you know, the debate for Horford or Whiteside could still pop back up because, you know, come fourth quarter time for the Heat, it's Whiteside that's been on the bench lately. So maybe they're not fully in on him yet.
Well, you know, I'm big on Horford. And look, you know, there are places that have Gay's salary at $13 million, too. I mean, it just kind of depends. At $13 million, he's a better get.
At $13 million, I don't think you're really
bad
an eye.
You have to trade for him, too, so you'd even out some of that salary.
Yeah, and at $13 million, is when we talk about contracts, specifically on the new CBA, remember that $13 million is more like $9 million. I mean, when you're talking about the increases in the revenue. So when you talk, just imagine in your head, and I know this is crazy, it is for everybody listening, that it's important to realize that Rudy Gay at $9 million is slightly more than what Aminu is getting right now.
Right.
So it's not a huge difference.
Well, it's possible. It's certainly possible. We got to wrap it up because we get us two talking and it will be hours and hours. But
this
we will
true.
Be back next week. Go ahead, Dan. What were you going to say?
I would say this is true. I mean, if anybody knows me, I can sit here and talk for hours.
And we will do that over the course of the summer and beyond. Thank you for joining us. For Dan Morang, I'm Dave Deckard, and we will see you next time on the Blazers Edge podcast.